I Love That For You, the podcast celebrating the late bloomers and trailblazers of all walks of life. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Red.
And Red, we're at the end of March. Explain yourself. How? Why? What is
explain
happening?
Myself. I'm asking the same question. It's not my fault.
It's the end of Q1.
Yeah.
What?
I will be almost halfway through my course. And I'm not okay about it because I just like, yes, I'm already like getting really excited to get out there into the work and like doing the stuff. But I also love being in the little bubble of school and enjoying what this time is before it's like, oh, now we do the actual work. Like we're doing work, but you know what I mean?
What era are you in? Because I saw that picture you sent me the other day when you were out in your 1930s makeup style. It was amazing. What are you guys working on?
So we're going to be wrapping things up at this point with fashion, which means then we're moving into theater. So prepare to see lots of video when we meet of me broken out because theater makeup, she is thick,
oh yeah,
which also is going to be so great for trying to meet somebody and being like, hello, don't mind the braille on my face that says I do makeup, can you tell?
Wait, now I want to know this story that you had.
Yeah, I've been teasing out this story with Kelly because again, I am trying dating. And honestly, with the balance of everything else in my life, it's definitely taken more of a lower priority. However, there's been some funny things that have happened. So when I first got to Toronto, like within the first month, I made a couple of girlfriends who they're just so fun. And one of them in particular, she and I, like we've been hanging out more and more. And so we went to a club and because we're both like, she's a stunning girl. Like she's Latina. She's just like, she dresses impeccably. She's just like this natural, gorgeous girl. And then there's me, which is not to say I'm not pretty, but like next to her, I kind of, and also because of the way I act, you know me,
yeah.
I'm more the goofball.
Yes.
So like, here's this goddess. And then there's the court jester next to her. Like, hey guys, what's going on? So, but we were invited to join like the VIP area and we're hanging out. And I was just kind of like, I'm going to walk away for a minute. Cause like, I'm not a VIP kind of girl. I'm a hang out at the bar and that kind of girl.
I haven't been in a club in years. So kudos to you.
Well, I love going dancing. And
right,
so,
right. Yeah.
And so I went over to the bar and there was this very tall, very handsome guy. And we just got to talking because I was like, why are you? He was wearing like a sweater with like a collar. I was like, you look like you should be in a library, not a club right now. And he had a little bit of an accent and he was cute. I mean, handsome. And one thing leads to another and we make out at the bar and then I walk away. And when I look back, he was with another girl, not kissing her or anything, but I was like, oh shit. Like, what? Did I misread that? Like, cause again, drinks were involved, that sort of thing. So then, funny story, my little, I say little, they're not little, but my kiddos that I keep calling them.
Yeah, right. You're the
swiping
aunt.
Away, swiping away, swiping away. And they're like, ooh, this guy's gorgeous. And I look at him and guess who it is?
No way. Did you match the message?
We matched and he was very funny. Again, like English is not his first language. So
where is he from?
From Croatia. So I was like, well, hello again. And he said, hey, you, long time. We kiss and I never see you again. I'm like, so he does remember. So anyways, we've been talking and I don't know. It seems like it's going to be something that's more fun. And again, with my schedule and everything, I'm putting no pressure on this. And again, like I'm still in touch with the guy. I know you don't approve. But again, it wasn't really petty. It's just,
all right.
There's a lot of confused feelings. I know you are. And that's the thing. And
yeah,
he's
like
also
it.
Protective of himself. And it's very confusing to have feelings for someone that you can't be with. And yet you want them in your life because you care. But then at the same time, you are hurting because you can't be with them.
Mm-hmm.
I get that because it's complicated. And I wish him all the best. And I would love to have him in my life still. But at the same time, it is confusing. And it makes it hard to move on. But that being said, it's not like we're holding each other back. I feel like he's going to meet someone amazing. He is a really amazing guy. So it sucks that it's not going to be with me, more than likely.
But he's going to visit you and then watch him fall in love and like move up there to be with you.
That's asking too much of somebody.
Know.
You know, I'm not that kind of person. I'm not. I want to find somebody who also is very, this sounds weird, but I want someone who actively is with me, not someone who is like, oh, I could take or leave her, or I want someone who actively chooses to keep being with me and who makes the effort of, you know, I don't want somebody who I have to second guess how they feel about me. I want somebody who is just open and makes me feel not if we are together, but isn't it great how we're together?
Right.
You know, where it's not like that. And again, there's a lot of protecting of feelings and all that other stuff, but I just want somebody who at the end of the day wants to call me and at the end of the day wants to make out with me at a bar.
It is a small world, right? Like, that's crazy.
What is small, but at the same time, Toronto is smaller than, like, I mean, it's big, but it's also small. Like, it feels like a big, small town at times. Because everybody compares it to New York, but I wouldn't say it's like New York. I'd say it feels a little bit more suburban in a way. Not suburban, but, like, the sidewalks are wider. Like, the people are nicer. People are spread out. Like, the city is more widespread than condensed. Like, it doesn't feel like everyone's...
LA and New York combined. A little bit.
Yeah. I would say it's like the perfect little love child between the two. And I'm like, you know what? I think that's more my vibe.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And yeah. I can't wait
Which
to visit
also reminds
you
me,
summer.
You do need to come visit.
I was going to say, I feel like I'm going to be there before our wedding in June. I'll either be in Buffalo the last week of May or the second week of June. So we're going to have to record like live while we're there and just get into some trouble.
Absolutely. And we're going to Shameful Tiki. We're going to, you're going to love that place.
Oh my gosh.
I'll see if I can invite some of my kiddos. Again, we say that, but they are like 19, so they can legally drink up here. They can come out for a good time.
Do they have any? Yesterday I had a lot of fun. I went to Drag Brunch, remember that, in New Orleans, followed by an escape room. Do they have anything like that up there?
There's definitely drag up here. I go to Drag Me to the Movies all the time.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We have to
We'd have to. I mean, that sounds like, so you went to Drag Brunch and then an escape room.
Oh, yeah. Right across the street, they had opened an escape room. So we did the Pirates of Tortuga and we got out with 7 minutes to spare. And it was my first one and I was useless, but I see the appeal and now I'm like addicted. I loved it so much. And it was like,
so we'll
tiki
give it
adjacent.
A try up here.
Yeah, it was really fun.
All right. Let me see if I can find a tiki themed escape room. So many things. Like, and that's what I love about Toronto too so far. There's so many things to do. I just feel like there's always something happening in the city. It's just not one of those like cities where everything is just all there, like in the sense of like, oh, here's this happening, this, you have to kind of dig for it. Like somebody told me Toronto is like a treasure chest, like a pirate's treasure chest. You have to dig, but once you find it, you're gonna find so many riches, but you really have to look for it first. It's not a city that's just gonna offer it all up right out there. You have to talk to people, but they'll be willing to tell you. Like this summer, one of the girls I was telling you about, she was telling me about how they have like DJs that spin techno on the beach, which I live right by. So,
oh my God.
Not that I should be able to hear it from here, but like close enough that I can walk down.
I feel like I need a week up there just to get all the activities in.
I know. Or you could just move here. That's fine.
I mean, it's close enough to Buffalo. Why not? I do like it up there a lot. There's
I'm
a lot
just
of
saying.
Entertainment. So, but in this spirit today, Red, I'm going to highlight the winners from our friendship poll last month in honor of the end of Women's History Month. Very exciting. And you already know who it is, but I have to say this
duo
won. They won by a landslide, and I'm glad they did because I never really like looked into them too much. Obviously, I knew about them; they're iconic, but I didn't really know what I know now. And I'm so excited to talk about the lives and friendship of two of the most celebrated modern artists of the 20th century: Frida Kahlo and Georgia O'Keeffe.
Bah, bah, bah.
Bah, bah, bah.
Love
so,
them.
We got a lot to talk about. I'm gonna
yes,
have to
we
cut
do.
This thing down. Oh boy, there's a lot of shit. So let's just get into it. So high level overview of them both, though. O'Keeffe's paintings, they distill nature into crisp lines, abstracted forms of modernism, while Kahlo's paintings are bold, uncompromising, and deeply personal. Both women were married to influential men who introduced them to public life. So Alfred Stieglitz for Georgia, Diego Rivera for Frida. Both were widely photographed. Each were known in their lifetimes for their art as well as how they looked and dressed. Georgia famously wore simple black and white dresses and suits. It was kind of like a uniform a la like Steve Jobs. She didn't want to be bothered with picking out colors or else she would have no time to paint. And colorfully patterned Mexican attire for Kahlo. and both artists, obviously, I mean, have transcended the art world to become pop culture icons. And they were both feminist symbols, feminists, and had somewhat of an indifference to men. Georgia hated it in particular when people used Stieglitz as her last name. She wanted to be her own woman. Both women never allowed their lives to be one way and their paintings another. They were one in the same.
Yeah.
So very similar trajectories, although Georgia was 20 years Frida's senior. But let's start things off and meet Frida. So her full name is Magdalena Carmen Frida Kahlo y Calderon. That's a very long name. That's got everything.
but that's also, I think, common. Yeah. Well, I think because she's a Mexican painter, correct?
Right.
I think you had like your family name, your like given name, your Christian name, like there's like, I think there's influence like that. So people would have like the longest names, but they would typically go by a shorter version.
Yeah, that was a very long thing to write on any test or report card.
Right? Write out oh my God.
So she was born July 6th, 1907, outside of Mexico City. But being the revolutionary that she is, she always says she was born in 1910, which was the year the Mexican Revolution started. So already true to form. Love this. Love this for her. She was born and died in the same famous house that she grew up in, Casa Azul, or Blue House, which is now a museum. And her dad was German. Her mom was American Indian and Spanish, actually. But she was a daddy's girl, and he noticed she was different. Frida would dress in men's suits and European-style clothing, and he actually plucked her out of the traditional path of marriage that her sisters were on, because he was a photographer. So her first experiences like with art were on set with him, and she posed for him a lot, which would be very formative to her later paintings, which she's famous for her self-portrait.
Oh, yeah.
So she grew up in the photography studio with dad. But when she was six, she contracted polio. Long recovery. Permanently damaged one of her legs. Her right leg was smaller. And shout out to Bonnie and Clyde, she had a permanent limp. And this was a big deal, just the beginning of this lifetime of physical disabilities and pain that would be intrinsic, like all throughout every painting of hers, really big in her artwork. Her dad sent her to the German college in Mexico City, where she was further introduced to European influences. But sadly, she was sexually abused there and ended up going to the National Preparatory Academy in Mexico City. And she was one of the first women to do so. It was around the Mexican Revolution time. And she actually, I didn't know this, she wanted to be a doctor. And she was excelling at that. She was headed towards being a doctor. Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
But while there, Frida discovers this like zeal for the Mexican revolutionary spirit and learned more about her European and Mexican roots and started dressing more in her Mexican style clothing, very bright. She joined a revolutionary group called the Cauchuchas, which is narco slang for cops, but it stood for the caps or hats. And she fell in love with the leader of that group, but really found herself as a Mexican revolutionary and also became, did you know this, a fervent communist ideologist for her whole life. She was a communist.
Yeah.
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 So her and Diego, communists.
Because that comes into later in her life when it comes to helping certain people and stuff like that. But I'm sure you'll get to it.
Oh, and a word on her unibrow. I wasn't going to forget this. So the significance of it is that it's a purposeful statement rejecting stereotypes about what conventional beauty looks like. So there's that revolutionary spirit and feminism poking out. But in 1922, while at prep school, she meets Diego Rivera, a famous artist and muralist. And he was a giant, like literally and figuratively.
Mm-hmm.
And he was painting a mural at her school. And she would admire him and his work. Years later, they would meet again. But right now, she's still with this revolutionary leader, Alejandro. But this is a very formative, huge formative thing that happens in 1925. Now she's 18, so she's with her boyfriend, the Cauchuchas leader, Alejandro. And their bus was struck by a trolley. Or vice versa. The trolley was struck by a bus, or the bus was struck by a trolley. She was impaled by one of the handlebars. It went into her womb. She broke her spine. And Alejandro walks away unharmed. Like, what the fuck? Of course the men would. And she was...
I think some people were killed, too. So, I mean, yeah, it's just kind of annoying that, like, that one person is totally unscathed, but then, like, everybody else is devastated.
Yeah, it's woof. Like... Of course. And it was the most significant event of her life, this would be. And it would change the course of everything. Because remember, she's planning on becoming a doctor. And so over the next 30 years, she has in the range of 15 surgeries. And she was laid up and immobilized for so long that she gave up on her dream of becoming a doctor. And so she shifted direction. And it turns out, you know, laying there all day, her family got her this easel to paint, and they actually put a mirror on the ceiling so she could do self-portraits. Turns out she's a great painter. And she's like, all right, well, maybe I'll become a medical illustrator and explore anatomy as a metaphor for emotion. And this was radical at the time. You know, women can't do this. They can't express themselves on the canvas this much with this much, like, guts, you know.
Oh, no, God. Yeah. Of course they can't. They have their periods. They can't do that.
They can't.
But there are sandwiches to be made.
Sandwiches to be made and dishes to be washed, bitch. Get in that kitchen.
Again, listeners, we are clearly being sarcastic.
I hope they know that.
Yes. Please, everyone. By this point, you should all know that this is hard sarcasm going on.
Could you imagine? Yeah, we just change course, you know, and just be like women hating. So this idea is revolutionary. Like, women can't express themselves on the campus like this. This is so raw with all these medical and womb influences. But she's like, go ahead and watch me, bitch. I'm going to do it anyway. And so she recovers, and eventually she comes back to her revolutionary life and ends up in the orbit of Diego Rivera again at a party. And that was it for them. She's 22. He's 42. And he encouraged her and, like, was her mentor. She had asked him to look at her work. And was like, yo, am I an artist? And he's like, you absolutely are an artist. Also, let's get married. But here is a lovely quote from Diego about Frida. She was the first woman in history of art to treat with absolute and uncompromising honesty, one might even say cruelty, those general and specific themes which exclusively affect women. And this statement establishes her as an artist to be watched. And she was her own thing. Mexican indigenous art influences, sure, but as far as school of art, she would use primitivism, surrealism, indigenous, magical realism, and really, she would say, I don't know if my paintings are surreal or not, but frankly, they're the most honest expression of myself. Mm. And her most famous painting is The Two Fridas in 1939. Like, one side is her in her European clothing, and one is in her indigenous Mexican clothing, and the hearts are exposed in both, but the Mexican side, the heart's intact, and the European side, it's kind of open. Mm. So it's very interesting. So here we're going to catch up with Georgia. So from 1930 to 1933, Frida goes to the U.S. for her first time because, remember, Diego's a muralist. He has to go where the work is.
Right.
And so they move around a lot. And so San Francisco, Detroit, New York. Sometimes she liked it, but sometimes she didn't, like in Detroit. But in the 1930s, they found themselves in New York City. And Nelson Rockefeller actually commissioned Diego to paint a mural at Rockefeller Center. It was like a Sgt. Pepper's cover, but he like snuck Vladimir Lenin in the painting.
Yep.
And it wasn't in the original sketch. And Rockefeller was not happy. And that mural was destroyed.
Yeah.
And Diego would later recreate it in Mexico City as a big fuck you, and that would bring them back to Mexico City. But yeah, just went completely out of what he gave the sketch as and just did his own thing.
Like, I totally understand, like, wanting to make a statement, that sort of thing. But when it's a commission and it's something you've agreed to do and you've shown your proofs of what you are doing, and again, communism has always been a controversial belief for a lot of history. So to make a statement like that in support of that wasn't exactly gonna fly, and especially for someone like Rockefeller.
No!
Who, did I just say Rockefeller?
Rockefeller? Like, you know, I liked it.
Just, let's, my Rhode Island it. Showing.
Rockefeller.
But, yeah, any of the Rockefellers were going to definitely given their place in society and given their wealth and all this other stuff, they're not exactly going to be of that kind of viewpoint. Art is meant to create conversations and create, like, and stimulate and question things. But again, you're also being hired to do a specific thing. There are opportunities where it's like, okay, so we want you to bring yourself into this and create this. Whereas there's other times where it's like, oh, we're going to have you do this specific thing, and this is what you've agreed to do.
This is where, in December of 1931, Frida's at Diego's solo exhibition at the New York's Museum of Modern Art, and Frida meets one Georgia O'Keeffe. And Georgia is a rock star artist, nearly twice her age. She's 44, Frida is 24, and supposedly, since Frida was bisexual, according to one of Diego's assistants, Diego bragged that his wife had been flirting with Georgia at the exhibition.
My.
But let's learn
clutch
more about...
Clutch your pearls.
Yeah, clutch your pearls. How dare she? Or maybe he's turned on. I don't... It sounded like it.
Honestly, with Diego,
he
yeah.
He got off to it.
He probably enjoyed that.
Because he had many affairs, I will say, Diego, famously. And so did Georgia's husband, Alfred Stieglitz. So fun. But so were they. They were having affairs as well. Wink, wink.
Right.
But,
and again, it comes back to, what do you agree to? What is marriage to you?
Exactly.
Like we talked about last week with Maeve, Queen Maeve.
She openly
let people know, like, listen, this is part of being with me. You need to be okay and not have any jealousy because I'm going to have other partners besides you.
Communicate, people!
It's only wrong if you are not communicating your needs to other people and then acting. This is not one of those instances where it's like, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. No.
No.
That's different.
Discuss. Yeah. But let's learn more about this legendary eccentric painter, Georgia O'Keeffe.
Yes, please.
Shall we? So, Georgia O'Keeffe was born on November 15th, 1887, in a farmhouse in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, and her parents were dairy farmers. She was the second of seven kids, Jesus Christ. And by age 10, she had already decided she wanted to become an artist. And her sisters, Ida and Anita, they all received art instruction from a local watercolorist, Sarah Mann, so that really was a formative time for her, and that's when she's like, yeah, this is what I want to do, which is crazy. Like, that early to know? Amazing. Love this. And so she attends high school in Madison and then went on to attend the Art Institute of Chicago. So she does the Art Institute of Chicago, followed by going to New York City to study at the Art Students League. And she quickly becomes proficient at imitative realism. And in 1908, she wins the Art Students League Still Life Prize for her oil painting, Untitled, or Dead Rabbit with Copper Pot. Beautiful. But she believed that she would never distinguish herself really as a painter within the tradition of that imitative realism. And so she actually abandoned her commitment to being a painter altogether. And she took a job in Chicago as a commercial artist. But obviously, we wouldn't be talking about her if she didn't get reinvigorated. Right. So here's how that happens. While she's with her family in 1912, she attends a summer course for art teachers at the University of Virginia. She's all over the place. And she meets a artist and art educator, Arthur Wesley Dow. And Dow believes in the modernist idea that the subject of artists' work should be their personal ideas and feelings, and that these could be visualized most effectively through the harmonious arrangement of line, color, and notan, which is the Japanese system of arranging lights and darks. And Dow had rejected this imitative realism, which struck a familiar chord with O'Keeffe. She was kind of not having it. She was over this. This is what they taught in school, and she wasn't necessarily connecting with it. So she had this intuitive appreciation for this modernism style and aesthetic. So this completely rekindles her desire to be a professional artist. So later in 1915, she mails some drawings to this former classmate at the teacher's college, and this classmate receives them in 1916 and immediately takes them to New York City's famous avant-garde gallery 291, which is operated by photographer and impresario Alfred Stieglitz. And he was super impressed with what he saw. And so he actually includes 10 of her drawings in a group exhibition at this famous gallery 291 in May of 1916. And in April of 1917, he sponsors a solo show of her work. Huge deal. And
yeah, no kidding.
So she actually, again, moves to Texas all over the place. Becomes the head of the art department at West Texas State Normal College, and her work there is in response to the vast plains, the open skies, and dramatic landscapes. She loves abstraction as a means of expression. But she gets sick, she has an illness, and she takes a leave of absence in 1918. And so Stieglitz actually offers to support her painting for a year. So she moves back to New York in June of 1918. And although he was actually married and he was 24 years her senior, the two fell in love and began living together. And then they were married in 1924 after Stieglitz received a divorce. So there should have been some more open communication there. Again, Red, I don't know what these people are doing with their marriages and relationships.
A lot of overlap. That there is a lot in common between the two, just because, yeah, again, Diego absolutely. And her, I believe Diego was married when he first met Frida, yes, as well.
Yes, and he was a womanizer. I mean, let's be real. Yeah. And machismo was definitely a downfall to that relationship, but you know, they fell in love at some point. They had a very tumultuous relationship, Frida and him, and I guess the same could be said of Georgia. Lots of similarities. Mm-hmm. But we still have, man, Georgia's got a lot. So Stieglitz, he works so hard to promote her and her art. Problem was, he was equating the creative process with sexual energies, and like, he defined her work primarily in terms of gender, declaring her imagery the visual manifestation of a sexually liberated woman. And many presented her in the nude or in various stages of undress, because he had like exhibited a large number of photographs he had made of her in 1921, and sometimes posed in front of her abstract drawings and paintings while gesturing towards them with her arms and hands. And so his association of her abstracts with her body captured the imagination of the critics, whose reviews of her next exhibition were very Freudian. And O'Keeffe had become one of the most celebrated modernist artists by the late 1920s, which was great, but she was a member of the National Woman's Party, the most radical feminist organization of the early 20th century. Okay. So she kind of rejected the essentialist notion that women possess a set of particular character traits. And so she strongly objected to gendered interpretations of her work, as well as like the sexualized public image that Stieglitz had created of her.
Yeah.
And so in an attempt to,
because the other
to,
thing
like,
too, when is this again?
This is in 1920s now. Wow. Or 1920s.
I mean, yeah, to question gender norms like that at such a time period. Oh. I also get bothered by the fact that it's like, oh, here is the work as I interpret it, not as the artist.
Right.
But as
him,
right,
like what he's saying,
right. And it's like, but this is my artwork and you're bringing other things into it, which again, artwork is meant to be interpreted, but it's like, you're saying this definitively, this is what this is, and you're leading people to believe that this is what this is, when yeah, in actuality it's up for interpretation, and gender is not something that I brought into any of my work. Yeah. It's you that's doing it. So what the fuck, buddy?
She was very annoyed by this. It was a big thorn in their side throughout their whole relationship. But she had a hit, like her career, to, you know, it's unfortunate, but like, or maybe not. I don't know. It's a double-edged sword. He launched her career. She was kind of at the mercy because she's still a woman and men have all the power. So she kind of had to go with it. But she, to her credit, she began attempting to reshape this public image on her own. So she promoted herself at this Anderson Gallery exhibit in 1923 as this serious, hardworking professional, and she began to cultivate this public image that was antithetical to the one that Stieglitz had presented of her in this exhibition. So that love that she's trying to redefine herself as a painter of, well, now she's in the mid-1920s, she's becoming a painter of recognizable forms, which she remains best known for today. Obviously, her flowers are very, yeah, you know, famous.
Which, of course, so many people, yeah, have been like, they're vaginas. And it's like,
Yeah. That's actually, that's what people were saying. The ovals, the hooked or V-shaped spirals, the flowers, vulvas, you know, all these sorts of things.
I feel like, but I was saying this recently, but I was like, y'all are just repressed horn dogs that need,
exactly,
to get it out somewhere. And so you're
literally
looking and seeing this, and it's like, this is more of a Rorschach test that says about you than it does about the actual work.
100%. So critics were always using this as further proof of her female nature as the basis of her art, and the works usually called attention to the center of a flower, which for the most part are androgynous and thus not exclusively feminine. That's
oh,
what
please
O'Keeffe was saying.
Like, these critics could actually find the clit.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But yeah, all of her paintings speak to the modernist aesthetic of less is more. So O'Keeffe, now we're almost getting to the meeting. So she's in New Mexico painting landscapes and finding new inspiration and stimuli in 1929, 30, 31. She makes some brief trips to Canada to paint. And in the fall of 1931, she accepts this mural commission at the Radio City Music Hall. However, this is ultimately abandoned because of technical problems. But I think the universe was shining down on this world because it was good fortune because this is when she and Frida meet. Now,
yay!
I want to point out that the story of their friendship I'm about to outline is mostly one-sided from Frida's point of view, because most of the records that we have to date are from Callow, which the relationship likely meant more because Georgia was 20 years her senior, her mentor, she looked to her. No letters have been identified to date from Georgia. It doesn't look like she kept any memories. But I also want to point out that the bond, maybe loose. They weren't like BFFs. It was a lifelong friendship that was still very formative to both of them, and probably more so to Frida, but they still loved each other, could always, you know, be there for each other throughout the rest of their lives. So they meet in December 1931 at the opening of Diego's big solo exhibition at the New York Museum of Modern Art. And yes, they were apparently flirting. And it's just such a funny thing to think about, this, you know, unibrowed self-portrait woman hobnobbing with this eccentric painter of the abstracted flora. And it's just a very fun image to think about. And
what I would give to be at that and just right? see like that friendship start.
Fly on the wall. Side note, I didn't see the movie, but I imagine was this in the movie, Frida?
No. So I've watched Frida a couple times over the years because I personally am a big fan of Julie Taymor, who's the director. Ah. We definitely need to do an episode about her because I'm just such a big fan. I mean, she's behind the look of The Lion King, the musical version with like those costumes and everything. She did Titus, which was such a great interpretation of Shakespeare, but she also did Frida, and the colors and the usage of the imagery between the portraits, and it's just so well done. But unfortunately, Georgia did not make it into the movie. I don't know why. I think probably because there was so much that needed to be told with Frida's story, because again, it covers everything. Like, there's a beautiful scene, as gory as it is, it's beautiful the way that they interpret the bus accident scene with like this gold powder paint that kind of goes everywhere during the actual accident. So it's like horrifying, but also beautiful. Also, I told you I'd bring this up, but there was some controversy around the film because it would actually come up during the whole Me Too movement because of the fact that it was a Weinstein film that was made, and there were scenes of intimate moments between Frida, which was played by Selma Hayek, and female actresses that Weinstein demanded. In order for the film to be made, he wanted lesbian sex scenes.
I heard about this.
Which was not originally intended, right. But he wouldn't allow the film to be made otherwise. And literally, Selma Hayek said how traumatizing that whole experience was because it didn't feel authentic for the story. It didn't feel authentic for the movie, but because basically she was forced into it by Weinstein, who is in my opinion, this is not a fact, though some people may agree with me, is such a predator and shitbag. But it is our opinion that the harm that he did for women in filmmaking has had such a severe impact, and we'll still feel it for a very long time because of just how awful this person was.
Also rotten
and
hell.
Honestly, the fury I feel towards him and the complete empathy I have for so many women who unfortunately were victims of his throughout his decades-long career, and just the amount of power he had, and to do that to Selma Hayek, to other women, and to Frida's story. Fuck you.
Yeah.
Fuck you very much.
Fuck you very much.
And in our opinion.
A miserable life in purgatory of hell.
But the film itself, besides that, so beautifully done. So I love it so much. The only criticism I have is that we're missing Georgia. I would have really liked to have seen more. Like, she had female friendships in the film, but I would have liked to have seen that of Georgia's.
So going back to that, yes, it's very important to understand that Frida's friendship with her helped flesh out her very formative American years on this budding artist as she, you know, went back and forth between San Francisco, New York, Detroit, and really had a big impact on Frida's creative development. So sometimes the two artists would go on double dates with their husbands, and sometimes the two of them ventured out. This is from the author of the book Frida in America. I love this one scene from the journal where Frida, Georgia, and their friend Lucine go to a Mexican restaurant together. They drink tequila and they end up getting tipsy and singing in the toilet. I think that's just an amazing image. But they're just like you and me, these icons. Frida and Georgia, it's just getting shit-faced and singing, quote-unquote, into the toilet. Love. Love this. They're, you know, they're regal icons, but they're just like us. They're just girls.
I was about to say,
fun.
The amount of times we have been like yelling and like singing in bathrooms and stuff like that.
That's a rite of passage as a woman.
I was about to say, are you even like a woman if you haven't gone to the bathroom and had like a conversation
with your neighbor? Or right? Like asked if you should get with your ex at, like to the stalls next to you?
And everyone's like, no!
I saw that on TikTok the other day.
I love so that because again, we've all like been, there's a reason we go to the bathroom in groups, and it's because it is that much fun when you go in the women's room and just have those moments of just bonding over singing along and all that other stuff. And I'm so glad that this has been something that's been historical.
Yeah, it's a story tradition. Maybe going back to last week, Queen Maeve, I'm sure she had one of these.
Oh, I'm
many
sure.
Of these nights.
Right?
But their friendship wasn't all flirtations and tequila. The two women, again, were quite similar in many ways. They both played with fashion, dressing themselves in striking ways outside of the mainstream feminine vogue. Again, they both pursued and flourished in their careers while married to older, unfaithful, and powerful male artists. And both were very fearless, flamboyant, and powerful personalities. So this author again says they automatically would have been attracted to each other. So in addition, again, Frida was looking very closely at George's paintings. And in the spring of 1932, Frida and Diego leave New York for Detroit. And Frida paints self-portrait on the borderline between Mexico and the United States. This is in 1932. And this is a canvas depicting Frida in a pink gown, dividing a bleak landscape of American industry on the right and ancient Mexican ruins on the left. And so on the Mexican side, there's a few jack-in-the-pulpit flowers that sprout between other plants. And this is a flower that Georgia devoted an entire series to just 2 years earlier and wasn't indigenous to Mexico. And you see not just one of these flowers, but three. You see the growth of it, the process, like one's fully closed and then one's open, and that's what Georgia showed in her series, the whole process of growth from different perspectives. So direct impact on Frida's work is Georgia's these flowers, these jack-in-the-pulpit flowers. But even so, and in Detroit, it was unclear whether Frida would see Georgia again, and Georgia's influence on her lingered. And the next known contact was when Frida phoned Georgia in late 1932 after learning that she had actually suffered a nervous breakdown and had been hospitalized, which is a shame. She was having a lot of issues in her marriage, and some of her work projects were falling through. And this is a letter. It's just fascinating to read. It's a letter from March 1st, 1933. Frida's 26 here, Georgia's 46, and it's preserved in Yale. Frida writes to Georgia, and here's the letter. Georgia, was wonderful to hear your voice again. Every day since I called you, and many times before months ago, I wanted to write you a letter. I wrote you many, but every one seemed more stupid and empty, and I tore them up. I can't write in English all that I would like to tell, especially to you. I am sending this one because I promised it to you. I felt terrible when Sybil Brown told me that you were sick, but I still don't know what is the matter with you. Please, Georgia, dear, if you can't write, ask Stieglitz to do it for you and let me know how you are feeling, will you? I'll be in Detroit 2 more weeks. I would like to tell you everything that happened to me since the last time we saw each other, but most of them are sad, and you mustn't know sad things now. After all, I shouldn't complain, because I have been happy in many ways, though. Diego is good to me. And you can't imagine how happy he has been working on the frescoes here. I have been painting a little too, and that helped. I thought of you a lot, and never forget your wonderful hands and the color of your eyes. I will see you soon. I am sure that in New York, I will be much happier. If you are still in the hospital when I come back, I will bring you flowers, but it is so difficult to find the ones I would like for you. I would be so happy if you could write me even two words. I like you very much, Georgia. So, like, childlike, clearly just infatuated and loves her. Such a deep love.
Right.
For her mentor and lover.
Yeah. What a effort to make, too, when English is not your first language.
Right.
And it's not like back then you just go to Google Translate.
No.
And, you know, you had to really make the effort to do that. And also so many kind words that she's saying to her. And, like, I particularly like the line where it's like, you don't need sad things right now.
I'm she's just so aware. And, you know, she's going through it, too. But she's putting Georgia's first and making time and writing so many drafts and agonizing over flowers because Georgia's the flower queen. Like, it's just so cute.
Also, so I know you were saying that a lot of letters weren't found from Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
But this was received by Georgia.
Right. I think this was the Frida state, I guess.
Well, but what I'm saying is it sounds like Frida actually was the one who didn't hang on to letters from Georgia. Georgia held on to letters from Frida.
Good point.
Not to say, like, so it is one-sided, but I can also see how Frida might be.
Because it's the only letter I could find that's saved and documented in a place. So I'm glad we have this
one. Sweet
letter.
Yeah. If that's how they, like, spoke to each other. And, like,
I
love some of the things because, again, you're making that effort with the words that you aren't used to writing or speaking. That I love that she says things like about her hands and the color
her
of
her beautiful eyes. Yeah. Hands. She likes her very much.
What an affectionate.
It's so
cute. Right? Ooh.
So Frida would go to New York 2 weeks later and visit Georgia before Georgia went to Bermuda to continue her recovery. Georgia, you need a private jet at this point. She's like Taylor Swift. She travels so much. I mean, she was very well to do. I mean, her estate, I think, was at $70 million at one point.
Well, true. But what I'm saying, it's not so much about that. It's also like you're sick and you're making the effort to go all the way to Bermuda with travel from the 1930s.
Yes. Crazy.
Ugh.
So Frida rehashed their reunion in a letter to one of Rivera's assistants. And she said, "She didn't make love to me that time," she lamented. "I think on account of her weakness. Too bad."
Aww.
So obviously this wording implies that Georgia had made love to her before, but it was unclear what she meant exactly. But some scholars argue that Georgia had romantic relationships with women, even though there's no evidence. But the term make love had a variety of meanings, I guess. It might have meant flirting, but I don't know if we'll ever know.
We're talking about someone who, how Frida would use that term versus someone who, like, would know the connotation of, because she might mean make love, she might mean it sexual, or she might mean it like, oh, this is like how we express love, or this is how we, because again, it's up for interpretation and we can speculate all we want, but it sounds like neither woman really came forward and confirmed. They just were doing what they do and we need to respect that. Like, we don't need to, like, be like, oh, did they do it? Okay, brah. Like,
And Weinstein would love to know.
Right. But it's just more of, I think for them, there's clearly like this beautiful, deep affection for each other, and whether or not it was sexual or not, I think that's great.
Yeah. So to finish that out, there was one small trace. They found O'Keefe's address book from the early 1930s, and there was a Chicago address for one Frida Rivera. That's her married name. And when Frida was in New York in 1933, her next scheduled destination was Chicago, but it fell through because of the controversy surrounding the Rockefeller Center mural. But O'Keefe had it and had planned to visit her. But when Frida came to New York in November 1938 for her first solo exhibition, Frida's, Georgia was there on opening night. And it's possible they saw each other other times. Frida did visit New York on different occasions. And actually, Georgia would travel to Mexico in 1951 and visit Frida twice at her house, Casa Azul. And that last time, though, it was Frida who was confined to bed. She was recovering from recent operations. And she must have been thrilled to see Georgia, her old pal, who truly showed her what being a successful woman artist could look like. Georgia was the woman artist, like the representative, the token, the example. Like, think about how much Georgia, as like a friend, a person, a woman, an artist, might have been so important and fascinating and formative to Frida. And maybe Georgia brought her flowers. Maybe Frida offered her some local tequila. But the two were different people than when they had first met two decades earlier, and they hadn't been permanent fixtures in each other's lives but their bond, however loose, was still there. So we love that for them. Yeah. And just to round it out, you know, Georgia, she would, you know, go on to do things in New Mexico and kick ass and take names in the modernism world.
But of course.
she died in Santa Fe in 1986, and she's one of the most important, admired modernist painters in the U.S., and she really played a role in disabusing the art community and public of the notion that gender was in any way a determinant of artistic competence or creativity. She really set a new and significant space for female artists in a realm that had continued to be dominated by men. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Frida, she would continue to kick ass and take names and just amazing things. The Wounded Deer and My Birth are two of the best Frida paintings, in my opinion. There's one called What the Water Gave Me, which is the self-portrait of her in a bathtub from her mm-hmm. vantage point with her mangled toe over the side. And it's full of all sorts of things, like her parents on the wedding day, a bird, a nude woman. It's very graphic, but very beautiful. It's just very grown-up Frida coming out of the birth canal. Very, very beautiful painting. Frida had a lot of letters to Diego that were published. They had a very tumultuous relationship. Mm-hmm. They divorced in 1939 and actually remarried in 1940. But they lived in separate houses. They had infidelities. They were very complex in their relationship as rivals, lovers, mentors, students. He actually once tried to have his doctor write him a note that said he was incapable of being faithful.
Oh my God.
And he had an affair with Men. Her younger sister.
Yep.
Which led directly to their divorce.
Okay, we didn't mean for us to have a theme during March of
I know,
sisters,
what is this? Women,
like...
women getting done dirty? Women's History Month?
Whoops.
But to finish off Frida, in 1953, she had this solo exhibition where Georgia was at, and she wasn't going to go, and it's kind of sad, but I kind of love it. And they did this in the movie, I heard. They brought yep. her in an ambulance with a four, you know, bed thing around it, four corners, four walls. And she was greeting people bedridden at this exhibition.
Yeah.
And she would die a few weeks later at age 47 after a
so
productive
young.
Life of pain. And her death, it's not, you know, it's people suspect it was suicide because she had taken 12 painkillers when she knew she was supposed to take 7, and she had actually given Diego his anniversary present a month earlier. So she had gone through polio, gangrene, pneumonia, this bus accident, and when she died, actually, her work was very dormant and, like, entered obscurity. It wasn't until the late 70s that it was rediscovered by art nationalists of Mexico. And she obviously has been a pop icon ever since. Like, you can't overstate the importance of Frida on the art world and feminism. And Frida, the movie, was actually the highest grossing art-based movie of all time. Fun fact.
Oh.
So, Frida and Georgia, we absolutely love that for you.
We do.
What
and I mean, it's so funny, too, because you look at the two of their... like aesthetics, their art style, and you would think like, oh, these two are so different, and yet they had so much in common and
yeah,
so much
really
to learn from each other. And I just find both of them so inspirational and so funny in a way of like the ability to come together over their differences, but then also find these moments of like dear affection. Like again, the bathroom thing that makes me
yeah, seriously,
like that.
I love that image so much. Ugh.
Yeah, and
so
I just,
cute.
I find both of them to be so interesting in the sense of, like, how you make that impact on the art world and how you use these, like, friendships and even something more significant than that in some cases to kind of help your artwork and define your artwork and to do it in
Take
your
down
own...
Take down the patriarchy! Sorry.
Yeah. Well, live your own truth, whether it
yes.
be, like, again, like, because again, she was arguing against like putting gender into it when it's like some people are going to see that, but other times it's like stop telling people that's what this is. That's your interpretation, but let the art speak for itself. Stop putting your opinion on it for others to hear as a definitive. I'm the artist. Let me let my art speak for itself and how people want to interpret that. Because especially Georgia's artwork is so,
oh,
I find it's so beautiful. And like, it seems simple when you look at some of the images, and yet it's so complex at
Absolutely.
The same time. I just, I admire both of them so much. And I don't know if we have time for it. I figured I'd do a little bit of an artwork edition. And this first one is a toughie.
Oh, okay.
So do we love owning a painting by Frida or by Georgia?
Oh, no, Red. Why would you do this to me?
I know.
Oh, no.
Because, again, their styles are so different from each other. Ah. I'm like, I want to own both pieces, but...
Oh, Red. How dare you start off with this?
I'm so rude.
Okay, well, what was your answer? Do you have one?
I actually wanted... I think for myself, as striking as Frida's artwork is, I kind of like... For me, when I look at George's work, it's a little bit more peaceful. So if I were to own a piece,
right,
I would actually want to have something by Georgia, because yeah, I feel like in my own home, I want something that's very, like...
Right.
Like, not to say... Because Frida's work is so striking, and
yeah,
it tells such a story, but the story is very, like... very poignant, very, like, it's very disruptive in a way, which is great, but at the same time, I'm like, at home, I want the beauty of George's paintings to kind of help me relax and, you know, feel a little bit more, because for me, when I look at it, it's very peaceful.
I would have to agree. Like, I think if I had a gallery and I own a gallery, I would probably go hog on Frida.
Yeah.
Just because of the, I mean, they both had tons of meaning.
If I were to have, like, a creative space that was open to the public, I would put Frida in.
I would
no questions asked. Yeah.
But if I'm at home, absolutely. I want to not be, you know, as much as I love what she did and stood for, it's a lot of pain and gruesome imagery.
Rightly
so. That was a big, like, theme in her life, but I don't necessarily want to see that while I'm in, you know, my living room.
Right.
Or in my bedroom. So
exactly.
I think for the house, I'll go Georgia, but if I had a space, I would look for Frida first.
Totally understand that.
Yeah.
So, again, I'm not a very artsy person as far as
either.
Like in certain regards. Like so do we love painting with finger paints or drawing with colored pencils?
Oh. Ooh. I feel like I do more with colored pencil as an adult, but as a kid, there's nothing more freeing and liberating than getting down and dirty and finger painting. There's just something so, like, just childlike and nostalgic about it. So I guess it depends on the mood I'm in. I would say if it's like, if you were to tell me to do one of them right now, I would break out my colored pencils.
Yeah.
But if I was feeling a certain way and, you know, I wanted to get my, you know, my childlike wonder on, I would definitely finger paint for sure. Yeah. What would you do?
I have a thing with textures and stuff, so I really like colored pencils because sometimes the finger paints, sometimes the texture of it can bug me. So because of that, I typically like more of the colored pencils, and also it reminds me of like a makeup brush. So I feel like I like more of that feel to it, because I'm rarely, because some makeup artists do it where they use their hands on someone's face, and I don't really do that. I've found that's a habit of mine that I don't really like. I use more brushes to like smudge out different looks and stuff like that. And some people will use like their hands, and in certain industries, it's more welcome than others. So yeah, for some reason, maybe it's because also I like to write. I'm just better with pencils.
Yeah.
Three more.
Okay.
Which body part do we love painting with other than our hands if given the opportunity?
Oh, I guess what would actually make sense?
I mean, it depends.
It's like an elbow, like, or a foot, right?
I mean, you could do any. So, okay, this is. It would be so fun to do like a full body paint, like on a easel,
make it
the size, right?
I've seen people do this, and it's actually really beautiful. Like, they use their whole body.
Because I've seen, like, some people who are dancers have, like, put stuff on their, their tap shoes, and they tap out different stuff.
Oh,
I've seen people who use, like, their hair as, like, a brush. There's so many. People are so creative with it, but I always thought it'd be so fun to, like, maybe this is a little sexual, but I always thought it'd be fun to have, like, a paint fight with someone on, and then, like... That would be, it could be with a friend or it could be with a lover. And you could just like see like what happens from there.
Oh, I
and
love
And just
that.
The playfulness of it. That would be mine, but what would be yours?
Yeah, I think I would, now that you bring up the tap shoes.
Because also you're a runner. Like,
that's what I was going to say. I think I would do something with my running shoes. Like Sean and I would do like a little fun, like, I don't know, our cadence of running, like mural or something. That'd be actually really fun. Different colors or whatever, and different shoes, like with the different soles, it might have a story. That would be actually really fun.
I know. It's because it's so funny. We think of things so, oh, you have to do it this way. And it's like, but why?
Yeah. Oh,
so,
that's a great point, Red. I like that. Ooh, good question.
Okay. Do we love creating art or collecting art?
I'm not an artist, so yeah, collecting.
Yeah.
And I wish I could make art, but I am not an artiste. I would definitely say collect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, again, it comes down to the loose interpretation of art, because for me, I like creating makeup looks.
And oh, that is art.
It's a type of art, which
it is.
So I love the idea of like trying different things, and with that, which is funny because I never considered myself much of an artist, but now that I'm doing this, I'm like, oh, there is like an art to it, and like playing
with
like
artiste, Red.
There's color theory and there's all this other stuff, and I'm like, oh, so basically my canvas is just someone's face.
Yeah, I would say creating art for you, absolutely.
Yeah, well, because also, unfortunately, other than taking photos of it, you can't really collect it. Like, it's one of the most frustrating pieces of art,
parts
too,
of
because
it.
Once you get rid of it, like, it's gone.
That's sad.
Yeah.
But at least it was beautiful while it lasted on, like, a wedding day, which is immortal. It'll always be around in the pictures.
And final question for you. Do we love the idea of being painted? And it's not Frida and Georgia, because, again, they didn't both do portraits. I mean, at various points they did, but I thought, because their style is so different, do we love the idea of being painted by Picasso or by Warhol?
Oh.
Because, you know, their portraits are just so distinctive and so different. Who would if you could have a portrait of yourself done by one of those two to hang in any space, who would you prefer?
Warhol.
Yeah.
It'd have to be. It's just so iconic. Like, no shade against Picasso, but, like, there's a reason. Like, I mean, that Marilyn Monroe one, come on.
I know.
I would love to see that of me.
Oh, I'm sure. That would be so cool. I'm going with Picasso, though.
Oh, you are?
Because I love the idea of, like, that whole disjointed kind of look to Picasso's work.
Oh, interesting.
It's like, if I don't like how it turns out, it's still like a very interesting piece. I feel like Andy Warhol's stuff is very
literal,
true to the person. And like sometimes I'm a little critical of how my appearance and stuff like that. So I think if something were intentionally done a little different, I think I'd be more open to seeing myself that way instead of being like self-conscious.
Oh, these are great questions, Red. I love this.
Thank you. Well, on that note, I hope that everyone has a lovely and inspiring friend in their life who helps them elevate whatever their work is or whatever makes you happy, whether it is creating artwork or maybe just enjoying a good meal or some wine.
Absolutely. And you can go into the bathroom and sing in the toilet with them.
Right. I wish everybody a friendship where you could just sing to your heart's content on the toilet together.
Amen, Red. We love you guys.
Love you.
Bye.
Thank you for joining us on I Love That For You. Our theme song is by Vaudeville and used with permission. Our cover art is by Jenny Lamb, edited to the best of our abilities by Kelly and Red. If you want us to spotlight someone, have questions, or just want to say hi, email us at ilovethatforyoupod@gmail.com or join us on Instagram at ilovethatforyoupod to join the love fest and see what else we get up to. Episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, basically wherever else you listen. We appreciate all your love, and if you want to help support the show, please rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts. This helps us spread the love and reach more people. Thanks for listening. We love you.